This time on your weekly Constitutional, the president of Montpelier, Kat Imhoff.
I think people are still in the process of discovering us. We're also in the process of still becoming, and it has maybe allowed us sort of jump forward in a couple of ways in terms of our cultural institution experience.
What does it take to run a presidential home? There aren't that many of them out there, and to some extent, they compete with each other for decreasing numbers of visitors. Kat has provided some remarkable leadership in the past 5 years, and today we're talking all about it. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week, it's a conversation with Kat.
It's time for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
There are only a handful of preserved presidential homes in the United States. And my favorite, of course, is Montpelier, the home of James Madison, the father of our Constitution. The leader of James Madison's Montpelier, its president and CEO, is my guest today. Her name is Kat Imhoff, and she's an extraordinarily accomplished woman. Before she came to Montpelier, she was the vice president and chief operating officer for the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which owns and operates Monticello right down the road in Charlottesville. She's also spent a lot of time with the Nature Conservancy, raising tens of millions of dollars to preserve our natural heritage. Now she uses her considerable skill set at Montpelier, and she does a bang-up job. I started our interview by asking her who she is.
Yes, who am I? Well, the name is Kat Imhoff, or Catherine Louise Imhoff, and I've had a really interesting career life. When I go to describe myself, I kind of always stutter a little bit because I've spent some of my life in local government, a lot of it in nonprofit, and that nonprofit work has been split between conservation and preservation, which seem sort of the same thing to me, but from an outside view could look quite different. So 37 years and counting in the professional field.
Yeah, in fact, the Nature Conservancy, if I recall correctly from your Facebook page. And they started out as your home state, Montana?
No, my home state is everywhere USA. My father is a water resource planner, and maybe that has influenced kind of why I do what I do or what I care about. But we literally lived all over the United States. And just to very briefly, born in Utah, Wyoming, California, New Mexico, Wisconsin, three different places, Idaho, Maine, Nebraska, Virginia, a little time in Switzerland, a little time in India. And then in my adult life, I've also lived in Montana, as you said. Michael Beschloss joked, because before I moved to Montana, I was at Monticello, and he said, what are you doing? Working your way through the M-O-N-T places? But, but this is it. I'm at the last M-O-N-T place, Montpelier.
Understood. I think you've lived in more states than I've visited.
My dad had a really unique skill set, which was to do water resource planning at the state level. Probably of that, the place that influenced me the most, and maybe not in a great way, in an odd way, but living in rural Maine, my brother and I were the first kids to come into the school system in about a year and a half, and we were ducks out of water moving from Boise, Idaho, to a little place outside of Bangor. And the first field trip we had, which by the way, ended up being the only field trip we had every year, and it was the same field trip 5 years in a row, was to go to Bangor and watch Gone with the Wind. So I grew up thinking Gone with the Wind, my sort of impression of the South was completely shaped by what I thought was a documentary movie. So it's been really fun to live in Virginia since high school and college and to really learn the richness of the history of Virginia. It's not all based on Gone with the Wind.
Kat, I'm almost speechless.
I know. I knew you'd love that story.
Because by the merest of coincidences, I decided last night as I was staying in the Constitutional Village, all by my lonesome, I had all of House 7 to myself. My wife couldn't come this time. I decided I was going to watch an old movie.
Was it Gone with the Wind?
The one I picked was Gone with the Wind. What I like to tell my students is that it is simultaneously one of the best movies ever made and one of the absolute worst. And I think you were hinting at that just a moment ago. It is, I mean, I've read the book too at my wife's insistence some years ago, which is even lengthier and much more detailed. Have you read the book as well?
I have, yeah. My mother was reading it when she was pregnant with me and giving birth.
I see.
That was the book that was read that sacred day.
This was imprinted upon
it was
you.
Imprinted.
Even in utero. It is such a good story. The characters are so compelling. Obviously, a very strong female lead, very resilient. I'll never be hungry again. God is my witness. All the rest of that.
It's the land.
The land. The land's Katie Scarlett. It's all that matters. I mean, there are so many compelling aspects to it. And, of course, there's a love story. And then the background of the war, the production values, the Technicolor in 1939 of all times, the great fire in Atlanta, all of those things. And you really can be swept up in it. And yet.
It's the stereotypes, right.
It's every stereotype that right. was brought about after the Civil War. The myth of the lost cause, the stereotyped roles that everybody had to fit into, from the masters to the slaves. You know, mm-hmm. there were the good slaves who were happy to be dominated. There were the bad slaves who went with the bad Yankees because everybody from up north is bad and a carpetbagger or a would-be rapist. I mean, every stereotype you've ever seen. And, well, I'm just going on and on, but what a coincidence. And so that was your first impression of constitutional history.
It was, except that my dad was a big historian and a very interested. So I was dragged as a child across the United States. And so my sense of American history is maybe more complete than other folks. Having lived in these different places, it was always about the history, both of those areas, but also of the different people who were there. So living in New Mexico, had a great sense of kind of tribal history from that area, or living in Idaho, the same thing. So maybe a little bit different take on it. The one thing my father did, and it's interesting that I have stayed interested in history, is that every single trip that we made as a family was for a very long time to a Civil War battlefield. So my first memory of Virginia was going to the Cold Harbor battlefield, which even then wasn't much. It was a big cornfield. I don't even think there was an interpretive sign. I don't remember one. And my father's going, and this is where men knew they were going to die, and they wrote their names on pieces of paper and stuck them in their clothing, of course, which is sort of the precursor of the dog tags that mm-hmm. people have today. And all I could think about, of course, I was fifth grade, was, is there any chance we can go to a hotel with a pool? That was what was weighing on my mind. But I think this relentless drip, 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 and this kind of continuous moving through the landscape across all of the country did leave me to a profound sense that place matters, going to places where history occurred matters, that there is a much more interesting and complete American story that most of us get exposed to. And it's kind of why I've been both very interested in saving wild places and saving the landscapes that have formed people, but also in finding ways to talk about this bigger American story that goes beyond our stereotypes and our myths.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I think we had parallel childhoods. Just about every family trip I ever went on was to a Civil War battlefield.
Did you also want a hotel with a pool?
Of course. of course I did. And, you know, all sorts of other distractions. And I always wanted to go to all the shiny, glitzy places and, you know, the Ripley's Museums and all that sort of silly stuff. And my parents, by and large, stayed away from them. It was pretty much a straight diet of historic sites and other things. But, you know, I eventually thought that that was what every family did. Colonial Williamsburg was a big part of my childhood. And I guess that really kind of brings us back to Montpelier, because mm-hmm. I sense that there is a different emphasis now with a lot of families. There's been a decline in visitorship to historic sites, or is that something you've noticed?
Yeah, I think everyone is struggling with, there's a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. It's not that people aren't interested, but you have a lot of choices, and the vacation time is different, and kids are caught up in other activities. There isn't sort of the big solid chunks of weeks and weeks in the summer where you as a family are going, what can we do together? But, you know, we do see a lot of travelers, heritage travelers, I would call them, people who are retired. And mm-hmm. there seems to be a steady influx of people who now with some free time. I'm very fascinated on trying to attract more people out of the D.C. area. D.C. is an incredibly interesting area, and it has huge turnover, so we hope to bring more people. But I'm shocked at the number of times I'm also just in Charlottesville, and people say, yeah, I've lived here all my life, and I've never been to Montpelier. And part of that is Montpelier's young. We are, as our nonprofit, the Montpelier Foundation, we're only 17 years old, which is a baby mm-hmm. compared to kind of our sister sites like Mount Vernon and Monticello. I think people are still in the process of discovering us. We're also in the process of still becoming, and it has maybe allowed us sort of jump forward in a couple of ways in terms of our cultural institution experience. So when you're going to come here, you're going to have, of course, a house tour, an interpreted tour, but you're going to do your own interpretation through the mere distinction of color. You're going to have 8 miles of path to walk on. You're going to be able to go to a really fun cafe. There are new places on the property, like the Gilmore Cabin or the train station, which you can explore on your own. And that's what we're finding is people really want a mix of experiences. They don't want the whole thing fed to them by a spoon. They want to have their own, create their own relationship.
I think they can do that here because the view shed, I believe that's the appropriate term, is almost completely intact. I mean, I'm sure trees have died and have grown and have changed a little bit, but where there used to be trees, there are pretty much trees now. Where there used to be fields, there are pretty much fields now. There's not a skyscraper in the distance. There's not even a lot of planes that fly over this particular area. So it's quite easy to look around and imagine that this is pretty much what James Madison or Dolly Madison would have seen in the day.
I think that's one of the things that really does distinguish Montpelier. It has this amazing, beautiful rural setting, and it always will. We own a little, almost 2,700 acres, and we really do control our view kind of ridgeline to ridgeline. And as you said, you can really step back in time and sense what that view would have looked like. The thing I enjoy also about James Madison and that we're really going to be shedding the light on more in 2018 is that he really was an early voice for conservation in the United States. You say today, all the trees, and it is. We have an old 200-year-plus forest that James Madison set aside. Mm-hmm. He did that because in his lifetime, he saw the complete destruction of the forests in this area. You know, every tree ripped off of the Blue Ridge, and he really worried about he was worrying before he would have heard Mark Twain's great comment about it doesn't take long to use up a continent. He starts writing about not only soil depletion, but the loss of the forest in a wonderful address that will celebrate its 200th anniversary this spring. So there's a part of the work here that is about being a national voice for conservation.
Yeah, he was quite a conservationist. There were many, many things to admire about James Madison. And of course, like all human beings, there were things that were not so admirable.
There are contradictions, for sure.
And there are contradictions. And if I may say so, well, first of all, let me remind myself, how long have you been here? About 5 years?
I will be 5 years in December.
5 years in December. Mm-hmm. You're a hard woman to nail down. I've been wanting to interview you on this show for that entire time, and you are always out. You're always raising money.
We're young, scrappy, and hungry. We're out there.
You definitely are out there.
Stealing from Hamilton, by the way.
Absolutely. Stealing from Hamilton. We need somebody to write a musical about Madison.
Well, we do. Madison's a little underexposed of the Founding Fathers, and he's the one with the hot wife, so it feels like there should be a musical about James Madison.
One of these days. But what's impressed me the most, I think, perhaps, in all the accomplishments that you've had since you've been here is the remarkable gift that you all secured from Mr. Rubenstein and the use to which you put it. So could you describe that for our listeners?
Rubenstein, who's known as a patriotic philanthropist and has been an amazing supporter at Mount Vernon, Monticello, the Washington Monument, many, many gifts, came to visit Montpelier, and I think he had not been here before. He had heard about how the DuPonts had owned the property, that they'd added lots of rooms to the house, and that the first thing the foundation did here was tear down 33 rooms to get back to the original 22-room house. But he didn't really know much more than that. He was a big fan of Madison. So when he came to visit almost 4 years ago at this point, he walked in. While we had some rooms furnished, a lot of the house still was lightly furnished or not furnished. And it just, I don't want to say broke his heart, but it really pointed out to him that he could make a gift that would help us accelerate. And things such as the entrance hall, when you visited here 4 years ago, it would have looked very plain. There would have been a few pieces of furniture and not a painting on the wall. And yet we know Madison had a really significant and large oil and art collection in that hallway. He was making a statement. The house was filled with objects. It was filled with people. It was a really busy, bustling, political place. It was, people came to him till almost the last day he died. And you wouldn't get that sense. You'd be walking through. It would be very quiet. It would feel like a museum. So we talked to David, and because of his gift, have been able to accelerate. And we'll be basically done by next summer. I mean, you're never done with a historic home, but you will be walking in and you will get that feel of bustle and objects and ways to tell stories about James and Dolly and all the people who were in the house. But we felt that the gift would not be successful if all it did was accelerate the furnishing of the house. If it didn't also go on to help us tell a more complete story of Montpelier, and by that, reflecting on the lives of the 300 people who made the Madisons' lives possible. Why did they have this free time? Why did they have this wealth? Well, it was based on the 300-plus people who were enslaved there. We'd been working for a long time with the descendant community, give this foundation an enormous amount of credit. The first thing they did was really restore the Gilmore Cabin, which is a freedman's cabin across the road, and also the train station, which was built and is interpreted to the Jim Crow period. These are pretty astonishing. But it wasn't enough, because if you're at the house and you see this 24 million plus restored house, but everything about your ancestors is just a couple railroad ties kind of outlining where we think buildings were, that was the challenge.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, my guest is Kat Imhoff, the president and chief executive officer of James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz and then we'll come back and speak some more with Kat. Stick around. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz, which was recorded before a live audience at the Potter Studios at Montpelier. Doug, how the heck are you today?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you?
I am doing. Every time I see you, I just think to myself, bromance. I mean, we have this thing going on here. I'm just always so happy whenever I see you.
You know, it's
you reciprocate, don't you?
It's always.
Mean, tell me, it's not just me.
It's always a pleasure to see you. It really is.
It's always a pleasure to be here in the Potter Studios, especially when we have a contestant. Who are you?
Well, Mary Waldrop from Fort Worth, Texas.
From Fort Worth. Is Texas still part of the Union, or have you all seceded yet?
No, but we may threaten in the future. You know, you never know.
I understand.
Go Dallas Cowboys.
Cowboys. America's team.
Mm-hmm. And I don't teach in Fort Worth. I teach about 28 miles away, but I teach AP government, regular government, and economics.
Wow.
Is there a wall going up down there? I keep hearing about a wall.
Yeah, I think they've started it, and they've fortified what we did have. So.
Uh-huh. And Mexico's paying for it?
No.
No, okay. Not yet. Well, maybe just it'll take a little while for that. Okay, Doug, do you have a question for Mary?
Oh, I sure do, Mary. Welcome. So I'm going to read you a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
Okie doke.
Here we go. According to James Madison, what is the greatest of all reflections on human nature? According to James Madison, what's the greatest of all reflections on human nature? Is it A, the reflecting pool on the National Mall? Is it B, our system of justice per Federalist 52? Is it C, government per Federalist 51? Or is it D, the presidency from whom the nation's character is defined?
Those are some interesting choices.
Okay.
The greatest mirror, greatest reflection on human nature.
What is the greatest of all reflections on human nature, according to James Madison?
Philosophical, okay.
Okay, can you give me,
A, the reflecting pool on the National Mall.
No.
B, our system of justice, as Madison wrote in Federalist 52. C, government, as found in Federalist 51. Or D, the presidency from whom the nation's character is defined.
I think it's C.
C, which is government. Why not our system of justice? Isn't that a good reflection on our national character as well?
It's that particular Federalist paper. I don't think that's the right number.
52. You don't like 52, huh?
I don't think it's 52.
Oh, she's a numbers woman. Oh, that's right. She's an economics teacher, so numbers are important.
What's your favorite Federalist?
Pardon me?
What's your favorite Federalist paper? You can only do that in multiple year, by the way.
You could only do that, exactly right.
So what is your favorite Federalist?
What's your favorite Federalist?
You know, we do the We the People program in Virginia and Washington, D.C., and there's nothing like a middle schooler saying, well, according to Federalist 17.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and then you don't dare, like, challenge her because she's
She knows
read
more
it.
Than you do. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah.
All right.
10 and 51.
10 and 51. Mm-hmm. Great. And so you're going to choose C? Federalist 51.
So I think it's the yeah, C. Yeah.
You are correct.
Congratulations, Mary.
All right.
Well done.
Federalist 51, government is the greatest reflection.
Because when you think about Congress and the two houses and all the voting, and then you think back then with Madison and then the whole Electoral College and who it was really they thought going to protect. And most people were not educated at the time anyway, so to me, C was obvious.
Well,
so.
No, that's a very good choice and for very good reasons as well, on a couple of levels. I think simply recognizing that 51 was one of Madison's is impressive in and of itself, and it is. Secondly, even though I thought choice B was not a bad one, the system of justice, that's fairly specific. And Madison was generally concerned with all of government. You know, he was a big picture guy. So I thought that that really was the correct answer even before I realized that that it was 51. So well done, Mary. You get a T-shirt.
Okay.
Thank you, God.
Absolutely. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my guest this week is Kat Imhoff, the president and CEO of Montpelier. We've been talking all about Kat's job and all the different things she has to do. One of the most sensitive things she has to do is deal with the issue of slavery. It's, of course, our original constitutional sin, and James Madison was one of its practitioners. How do you deal with that? Well, one way is you work directly with the descendants of that community and bring them into the process.
In working with the descendant community, they said two things that really struck all of us. One, don't keep our story in the past. This isn't just about 200 plus years ago. This is about the legacy of our forebears and what all of this story means in America today. And please, please talk about the humanity of these people. It's not just how much work they could do, or they're not just a footnote to history. They had lives, they loved, they had families, they had ambitions, they had talents. Let's talk about that. And so that's what we were able to do with $6 million went into the House and $4 million has been going into kind of telling this more complete American story.
And it has yielded remarkable results. A little bit of background about you again. You mentioned you work for Monticello. And I have a story about Monticello that goes back perhaps to the time when you were there. It was about, must be close to 20 years ago now. And I had an exchange student from Zimbabwe. Her name was Tembi Sibanda. Hello, Tembi. We still keep in touch. She's living in the UK now. And Tembi, obviously, sub-Saharan African. And was interested in going to Monticello. And we went down there, and it was lovely, and had a very, very nice time. And we got sort of the historic house tour, and a lot of emphasis on the China, and a lot of emphasis on Jefferson's many interesting inventions, all those good things.
The doors.
The doors, the hinges, I mean, everything.
The clock.
Everything about it. I mean, it is fascinating, but not much mention of slavery. And at a certain point, someone asked about slaves, maybe even about Sally Hemings, who was just sort of coming to light in the public consciousness at that time. And another guest, the tour guide, first of all, answered truthfully and straightforwardly, but very briefly. And then another guest, who apparently hadn't even liked the subject being raised, interjected, "Yeah, but he was a good master." And Tembi just sort of looked at me and said nothing. That was my experience growing up, going to these places in the South. I went to many presidential homes and all that sort of thing. It was, the issue was either ignored or it was whitewashed, no pun intended. It was, you know, the good master, the Gone with the Wind. Tale. That's not how it was. There's a lot of good history being done these days, a lot of good research being done. And Montpelier, I'm very proud to say, has been in the forefront of that because you took those slave cabins, or I should say you found those slave cabins.
Right.
and now you've reconstructed them. Please, please tell me about that whole process.
You know, one of the programs that's so amazing here at Montpelier is our public archaeology program. We have been at it for a long time. We also like the DuPonts. The DuPonts didn't plow a lot. And because of that, we have this incredibly intact archaeological record across the property. There really is something wonderful about being on land that was mostly raising horses for a long time. So,
you know, I think if you're president and you want your house to be preserved, sell it to some very rich people who do nothing but horses.
Well, they
and
came
they'll take
for,
care of it.
There were five owners in between, but they did eventually get here in 1901. So we're thrilled the DuPonts have left their own legacy here, which I shouldn't forget to mention that, an amazing equestrian legacy. But because it's archaeological record, we talk about it's given us the opportunity to make what has been invisible visible through the objects themselves. So there's so many myths about that time period. People didn't know how many objects enslaved people might own. We don't really know that much about their life. We're lucky at Montpelier, quite a lot of the folks who were enslaved here had access to literacy or were literate. So we have things in their own words. But the South Yard was an area which had six buildings, which we're reconstructing. And over time, basically, it just got knocked down and dirt spread over it and not ever disturbed how we came along. So we've been able to really very scientifically glean a lot of information about the people who lived there. You know,
As a point of reference.
It was meant to look, Madison made it look a certain way. Mm-hmm. So when you see it, it looks rather nice. It is right next to the house. So a lot of visitors go, was it really that close? And we're like, yes, it was, based on the archaeological record. We have the foundations. Well, it looks pretty nice. You know, it's board and batten, has glass windows, but the windows are small, and we've looked closer at the construction. It's kind of cast-off materials from the main house. Madison is making a statement of, look at how nice this is. It looks like almost middle-class housing of the time period, but it would have been an uncomfortable place to work. You would have been under the eye of the master and the mistress at all times. They would have been drafty in the winter. They would have been cold. I mean, drafty and cold in the winter. They would have been very hot and sweltering in the summer. And to that point of, was Madison a good slave owner? He certainly worried about slavery. He and Jefferson talked very frankly about what the legacy and what the reputation was going to be. He had no personal animosity for him. Ended up being more of a property rights issue. But no one's a good master when you can split up families, when people's fate is always hanging in the balance of how you're feeling about them or the whim. So yes, you might have a house, you might have food, but your family can be ripped apart at any time. So no matter how wonderful you might seem to the outside world, slavery was an abomination.
Indeed, indeed. In fact, even though I certainly would recognize that there were gradations and there were masters who were relatively cruel and those who were relatively benevolent, there's nothing good about slavery. And so I try to refrain from ever using that terminology. Just as a point of reference, if a person's looking at the mansion from the front, the South Yard is to the right.
It's to the
right.
And
so the slave quarters would have been visible to visitors
approaching
mm-hmm. From the front. But with a caveat, in fact, something I learned just recently on Constitution
Day. There were willow trees.
There were trees. Yeah. It was something, an area that your archaeologists are calling a grove that they think perhaps was actually planted in order, in some sense, to obscure or at least de-emphasize the view of the slave quarters.
Yeah, and when you're looking at the mansion, also to the left of the mansion is Madison's temple, which being Madison, of course, is a beautiful symbol of democratic republics around the world, but also is an ice house because he's ever pragmatic. And that had a row of pine trees leading to it. In both cases, these rows of trees would have created a forced perspective, which would have made your eye focus on the main entrance. So it's also a landscape architecture feature to focus on the house. But yes, you would have seen through the trees, the willow grove, you would have seen the South Yard, and you would have seen the pine allee and the temple. So Madison's very deliberate in his landscape. And that's going to be one of the wonderful parts of the work here we'll roll out in future years, is finding this, what we call the constitutional landscape, kind of revealing what it would have looked like during Madison's life.
Absolutely. In fact, pretty much everywhere you look these days, and I guess eventually the work will be more or less completed, it looks kind of like, it's an archaeological dig.
We have hundreds of years of work to still
do. Oh, really? I was thinking right around the house. Maybe eventually you get to that point.
Yeah, you know, right by the house there was stables and kind of a work area. We've just found what we think is the basis of one of the overseer's houses, which would be really interesting. We know when you're at the visitor center and you look down to the hill, you see some frame buildings, and those are kind of placeholders where we know there was a field slave quarters. So there's still an amazing amount still to reveal here.
You've mentioned field slaves, and there was a distinction, wasn't there? There, the people who were the house slaves generally tended to be the lighter complected people, in some sense more presentable from the master's perspective, perhaps. Perhaps the darker complected people were put out in the fields, and there were remote cabins there, which were not quite as nice, if I understand correctly.
Well, you know, I don't really know what people look like. I mean, in terms of describing. I don't know that that would have been the dividing line. It might have been more the skills that you were raised with or had access to. But yes, not everyone lived within, you know, immediate walking distance of the house. And because at the height of the plantation here, Madison had over 5,000 acres. So there would have been work places elsewhere. Though I often think you would have had a lot more privacy if you'd been in a field quarter. You would have been your little house. You would have been able to create caches where you could store things under the floor, and you wouldn't have been right under the eye of the main house. So I don't know. It's hard to
I think the facilities might have been better closer in, but you're right. Not to make too much of an analogy with just regular paid work, but there is an advantage to not having the boss looking over your shoulder all day.
Yeah.
And so maybe people who lived out in the more rudimentary areas and did the hard field work, there were some advantages to that. But again, that's part of the humanity of these people. They had different experiences. It was not monolithic. It was not a stereotype.
Right. And they had families and they had relatives. And some of their family would have been here at this plantation. But a wife might have a husband at a neighboring plantation. Children might be sent off in other places to work. It was one of the myths, I think, that's been busted for us is people who were enslaved here, they owned objects. They had complicated and deep family ties, sometimes over great distances. It was a much richer, more complex life than I think we have been taught.
Right. You've mentioned the new exhibit, The Mere Distinction of Color, which I had the pleasure of seeing on Constitution Day, and it was for the first time because it's just recently been completed. And it was very well done, very poignant. And I wonder if you could tell me about that.
Well, the exhibition has a lot of different parts. One, we wanted to really celebrate what we knew to date about the people who lived here. So one part of it really focuses what were their names? What were their family connections? Where did they work? What do we know they did on the property? And in many cases, we use the voices of descendants relating what they have known from their family history or what we've been able to find out from research. Part of the exhibit also is about busting myths by using the objects that we found here to talk about literacy. How did people feed themselves? Did they make their own clothing? We also use the exhibit to answer questions that people ask. Was Madison a good slave owner? Was this a typical plantation? There's two films that are part of the exhibition. One is called Fate in the Balance, and that takes just one story, a young 15-year-old enslaved woman, girl named Ellen, and talks about what happens to her. And I don't want to give that away, but I think we really learn about people through individual stories.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the exhibition, and it is in two parts under the house, we wanted to look back at the facts, which a lot of people have done, but we've done in a different way. What were the presidents? Which of them were involved in slavery in some way, shape, or form? And I think you'll be surprised by the answer. What were the economics?
I was surprised by John Adams.
Yeah.
Okay, now he didn't own slaves.
Right,
he did not. But his wife, I learned, was brought up in a family that did own a couple of slaves.
Yeah. When people sort of think this is a North-South issue or also something that was just way in the past and why are we talking about it today, one of the myths that we bust is that everybody was complicit in the slave trade. It made a lot of money from everybody from Maine to the Deep South.
Right.
Everyone had a role. But the other part of the exhibit is, as I said, the descendants, they wanted their personal stories. They wanted the stories of the ancestors. They wanted their humanity to shine through. And I think they've really helped us do that. But also we wanted to talk about the legacy of slavery today. how does it still resonate through our society? And there's a couple of different ways we do that, one of which is a film called The Legacy of Slavery, which is very powerful. But also we have one room that's just dedicated to the Constitution. And when you read the Constitution, it's not the lightest of reading. I mean, we tend to think of the Bill of Rights, but when you really dig in and read the preamble, there are parts of it that I know I've read in the past and said, I have no idea really what this means. Well, you come to find out a lot of the Constitution, while it never uses the word slavery, is set up to codify the institution. I think that's a shock for people as well. So while we can revere the U.S. Constitution and should, for so many ways it has influenced the world that we know today, it also, from the very beginning, had slavery codified into it. Then I would encourage everybody to go into all of the outbuildings. Yes, some of them are set up to look like they might have when people were living there, but they also have very many interactive moments, a lot of storytelling from people who were descended from people who were enslaved here. And we have some surprises hidden in the attic, so people should come and peek.
Mm-hmm. I saw some people peeking in one of the slave quarters. I didn't get a chance because there was a line of peekers. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Kat Imhoff, the president and CEO of Montpelier, who's been telling us about the challenges and the rewards of her job, one of which is dealing with the issue of slavery at Montpelier. There's been quite an investment there in recent years, and Kat's been telling us about the visitor experience. After the break, we'll continue our discussion with Kat, and we'll talk about all sorts of other interesting issues. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Kat Imhoff, the president and chief executive officer of James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. You mentioned a couple of things that I was very, very impressed by. First of all, the general approach of both giving the facts and the overview on the one hand, but then personal stories on the other. I think that's a really good balance. I like both the forest and the trees. I think we learn from each of them.
Ralph Applebaum, who was an amazing exhibit designer, said, you've got to design for the streakers, the strollers, and the studiers. Mm-hmm. And I think you can come and skim through the exhibit and still take away a lot, and you can spend 4 hours.
You certainly can. In fact, one of the things that I enjoyed the most was something you've alluded to, and that is that the Constitution is set out. It's set out on a great big tabletop. It's about, 8 feet long?
Yeah.
Something like that. A couple feet wide. So the entire original document, the original several and seven articles are there, and then there are a series of buttons along the side, and of course your hand is drawn to them and you press them. And then you realize these are all the clauses, these are all the paragraphs, these are all the sentences that obliquely supported slavery. And then there's an explanation. Some of them are fairly straightforward. I mean, you talk about people held to labor and the fugitive slave clause, it's pretty easy to spot. Or the three-fifths clause, you know, three-fifths of all the people. And if you know anything about the Constitution, you've probably heard of those. But you trace down something that I myself didn't know about until I really started focusing on the Constitution, and that is that the only clause in the Constitution that by its own terms could not be amended was a clause that you have to track down two or three different places, and you finally realize what's going on. They were protecting the slave trade for 20 years.
Right.
And that was a compromise.
It was. All of it was a compromise.
Right. The slave trade, you might wonder why people were particularly concerned about that, but the exhibit also shows you, you know, an outline of a slave ship. That was probably the single worst aspect of a horrible institution because the conditions people were brought across in the Middle Passage.
Yeah, 700 people to a ship.
Lying in their own excrement for weeks in tropical heat and having people die next to them. And the corpses just sitting there with
them.
Well,
and people really know that story, I think, better than they used to. As
right.
you said, that there's been an amazing number of books, and there's so many different places, both in D.C., Charleston's talking about an exhibit. The one that really surprised me was the research that our colleagues and staff did here on the internal slave trade. So, yes. They're not going to have, there's going to be a 20-year deadline. We're not going to accept any more imports of people from Africa, enslaved people. But the internal slave trade, of course, really ends up benefiting Virginia because we become the biggest distributor of people to other states, particularly after the Missouri Compromise, where the whole West starts opening up.
There's a fellow by the name of Ball who was very famous for writing a book called, I think it was called Slaves and the Family, about 20 years ago. And he traced his own family's history of slave owning, which was very difficult for him to come to grips with. More recently, he wrote a book, and we did an episode on that with a really wonderful interview. He called it The Slave Trail of Tears. And it was about exactly that phenomenon. Slaves were treated as property. But slaves reproduced. And so in certain areas there would be surpluses. In certain areas there would be demand. And the demand typically came from the Deep South, down the Mississippi River.
Well, particularly as sugar develops and,
right.
and as cotton moves.
And so there was a movement across the state of Virginia and across the Commonwealth and across other states as well.
The top three were Virginia, Maryland, and South Carolina.
And it's an extraordinary vision, isn't it, to think of these groups. In fact, I learned a new word. They were called coffles. I've never heard that word before. You would have groups of 10, 20, 50 people all shackled together, and they would literally walk down from here all the way to Mississippi in some cases. And they would be chained the entire time, and they would walk places that we recognize today, pretty much down the I-81 corridor. And they would go places that I know my family lived. In fact, it prompted discussion within my family, and it turns out, at least according to lore, that there were some slave owners in my family in Tennessee. I'd never known that before. Just extraordinary. And then that really brings it home. These people were here. They were at places we know, places that we see, and maybe our own families were involved in this somehow because, as you say, it was ubiquitous.
Absolutely. One of the places you can dig deeper in the exhibition is about what do we know about people who were enslaved here and where they traveled to. Or in some cases, one whole family group was sold by Madison. They wanted to be sold together, which was one of his accommodations or attempts at accommodation. And they went down to Louisiana, and we're still in the process of trying to see if we can find that family and hear their story and bring them into this conversation.
Well, we certainly hope that you can, and we wish you luck in your future endeavors in that regard. Again, I greatly admire being front and center about this.
Well, we love having you here because, of course, in addition to the house, we have the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution.
Where we sit right now.
Where we sit right now.
In the brand new Potter Studios with their lovely green insulating material all around us and having a great time doing that. The Center for the Constitution, to my mind, is perhaps the greatest distinction of Montpelier. I mean, there are several presidential homes that are equally impressive, the mansions and the grounds, that sort of thing. Monticello, where you spend a lot of time. Mount Vernon, certainly up there. But, you know, this is Madison's home, and he's got the Constitution.
He does.
And so you've got the Center for the Constitution. And could you tell everybody what the center does?
Well, the center has a lot of roles, but I think it's one of the, as you said, one of the high points of James Madison's Montpelier is we want to bring the past forward, and we look at everything through this constitutional lens. So the center has become a place for adult education. It can be both online. We have online courses, but really kind of the ultimate experience is to be able to be here on site, be in the places where Madison walks, see the room where he did the outline for the Virginia Plan that became the U.S. Constitution, and we work with practitioners around the Constitution. It can be anything from judges, journalists, police officers, teachers, anybody and everyone who in some way the Constitution touches them. One of the aspects, too, I think really fascinating is we continue to learn not only about our own Constitution and the issues we're facing today, the First Amendment and Second Amendments colliding, as we've seen in recent months, but people come from all over the world to look at our constitutional history and to talk about constitutions really worldwide. And, for example, we have a Young African Leaders Program that is usually here every July. This coming week, we have people from Myanmar, Burma, who are here having a conversation about what's happening in their country, which is pretty amazing time period as well. Mm-hmm. So I love this fact that we are a touchstone for this constitutional history, but also how constitutions continue to evolve, how we keep amending our relationships to them. And we're really that. We're a resource nationally and internationally.
And a wonderful resource. I agree with you. I think the gold standard experience here are the on-site seminars. And Doug Smith, the director of the center, has explained it to me as you're looking for people with leverage. You know, obviously a judge has leverage. He or she will be interpreting the Constitution, perhaps. Obviously a police officer has a great role to play within the constitutional framework.
Takes an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution.
Better know what's in there.
Right.
And we've got some issues with law enforcement these days, so there's a great focus on law enforcement right now.
Well, I'm proud of Virginia. The Virginia State Police have worked with us and have their own course that they're now taking. And I think we have over 300 state police officers signed up and in that process. It's pretty extraordinary to me.
Is that the online course or the online?
And then there's some on-site components.
Is that the interactive course, the online?
Yes.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear you say that because, of course,
you're in it.
I did it. That's an overstatement. I did it along with Jen, along with Mark, yes. along with several other people.
That's why we wanted to shine a light on it.
Absolutely. And I'm very pleased to say that we decided to do an interactive course, and then we decided to use some art. And the art is sort of comic book style. And the premise was that you take a day in the life of a cop. You literally start at the roll call at 7 in the morning, and then you go. It's a very long day. But this cop has one heck of a day, and it's written in the second person, so it'll say you encounter this or you encounter that, and it's just scenario after another.
And one of the things they encounter are cell phones, which has really changed policing and people's reaction and the ramping up or ramping down of hostilities. But I think it is really important, and we need to do things that can support our police. They are on the front lines and encountering a very changing and sometimes, as we've seen in the last couple of months, volatile world.
Absolutely. And that's what we emphasize to the cops. The very first thing we tell them is how much we admire them. And we're not there to criticize them. What we're there to do is to help them learn about the document that they're upholding, because in a very real sense, they are the Constitution. They're the face of it. So that's a wonderful experience.
Well, we're also hoping to do more, provide more opportunities for just people like you and me to be able to come in if we're interested in the Constitution and dig deeper. So stay tuned. We're looking at having some on-site programming in 2018 because people can come and stay overnight. We're hoping to do some short coursework with just the general public in the spring of 2018.
You mean I'm going to have to share my house?
You are.
Constitutional.
There's going to be wonderful people coming in to learn more about the U.S. Constitution.
Okay. Well, of course, as you know very well, Kat, one of James Madison's great causes was free speech and, by extension, freedom of thought, freedom of religion, a closely related concept.
Freedom of conscience, as
freedom
he called it.
Freedom of conscience, as he called it. And we have had quite a controversy here regarding free speech in the very recent past in Charlottesville. And if I understand correctly, you were right in the thick of it.
Yeah, I sort of ended up right in the thick of it kind of by accident.
Okay.
Not by accident, sort of a bit of both. But I was surprised to find myself there to some extent, but I'd be happy to talk about it.
Please. This is, of course, the infamous Nazi rally in Charlottesville, supposedly triggered by the removal of some Confederate statues, which resulted in several deaths and some injuries as well.
Yeah, it was a very tragic day. I ended up going in part because I care a lot about Charlottesville, but also one of my best friends, her daughter, was trained and was going to be there as part of the counter-protest, was going to exert her right of free speech to go, no, we don't believe in white supremacy. We don't want the Ku Klux Klan in our town. So it feels in an odd way like I was an awkward, you know, soccer aunt. Like, I'm going there to support you and be present. And I went down early enough thinking I would not be around by 11:30 or noon when the rally was supposed to occur. But by the time I showed up at 8:39, it was fully an event, and it was a hateful event. It was very difficult to see people really purporting Nazi propaganda walking through the streets of Charlottesville. That's just not who I think we are, and I don't think it represents what America stands for. And we had two world wars around this subject. So it really just gobsmacked you and became very personal very quickly. And you, kind of this incredulity that this could really be happening in our town.
Yeah, it's 2017, and we've got Nazis in the streets. And
white supremacists.
Yes, and they're all closely related. And it's very, very troubling even to acknowledge that fact. So, that's the initial reaction. Of course, the free speech analysis goes as follows. The government cannot regulate speech based upon its content, certainly not in its viewpoint, unless a standard called strict scrutiny is met. The government has to have a compelling interest that it's trying to further, and the restriction can be basically the least restrictive means of doing so. And in fact, there was a controversy in Charlottesville about that. There was an attempt to move this protest and counter-protest, therefore, outside of the city center, which was ultimately rejected by the courts. In fact, the ACLU came in on the side of letting the Nazis march where they wanted to. And unfortunately, there was a violation of that compelling interest in public safety. I mean, you can't always predict these things in advance. But that's what happened.
No, certainly couldn't predict that day. I think.
Did you witness any of the violence?
Yeah, well, we were unfortunately front and center, and it became You know, people have asked me, well, why didn't you just leave? You really felt as if you had a responsibility to stand there and say, no, this is not us. This is not our standard of behavior. We will not kind of we will not just be silent and allow hate to fill the streets. But you get pulled into it. So, yeah, witnessed the violence, witnessed the escalation, was there when the streets were cleared, when it suddenly became, you know, that everything was shut down and police were like, there's no lawful assembly, you all need to leave. You know, saw the tear gas, saw the violence. And it was just it was really heartbreaking, I think, for those of us who have maybe blindly gone along. I did, for the first time ever in my life, have the faintest inclination what it might be to be in a minority group and to be in a situation where you did not feel like you were safe and to be in a situation where you felt like your voice was not being heard and that there was that sense of helplessness. So I don't know if that's good, what good I could take from the day, but I think it was eye-opening to me just a little bit of what it might be like to be a minority living in this country.
I hope that neither you nor your loved ones were injured.
Actually, the young woman who was there as a protester was, luckily not severely, but still very traumatizing. And I think what does strike you is how quickly things do escalate and how it sort of built, the whole day just kept building on each other and, of course, ends in the tragic death with Heather and the two police officers.
Terrible tragedy. Well, let's move on to a happier subject, if you don't mind. I understand that the entire industry of presidential homes and historic sites is in a moment of transformation. What's going on?
I think it is in a moment of transformation. And I think institutions, cultural institutions, or whatever adjective you put on them, need to be the places where people do ask the hard questions and do really poise where we see contradictions in what we say we are and then how we really act. We become, I think, these moments of intersection. So I think it's very important, and I'm very proud to see both with the opening of the new African American Museum in D.C. and how incredibly well done and how popular that is for visitation, but that so many other institutions, such as our sister sites, Mount Vernon and Monticello, are tackling hard subjects and are not keeping the past in the past, but are bringing it forward to talk about implications today.
Well, I think that's another reason we should end on a promotional note here. That's another reason people should come to Montpelier. Sure, you're going to come and see an old mansion. Sure, you're going to come and see property that looks much as it did back in the day. Sure, you're going to see interpreters. You might even run into President Madison, who does a wonderful job, John Douglas Hall. But you're also going to see things that really do bring the issues that those people were wrestling with back then into the present day, because many of them, maybe most of them, remain unresolved, and it's an ongoing process.
Well, and it is our responsibility. It is we the people. It is our constitution. It's our blueprint for how we're going to work together. And Montpelier is one of the places that you can reacquaint yourself and think about what your own personal role and responsibility is.
Well, thank you, Kat, for speaking with us today. Thank you for all of your efforts in educating people and bringing this thing forward into the present day. And please, please, be careful the next time you go to one of those protests. All right?
I think I've heard a lot of that. Be careful, but be truthful and be present. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Kat Imhoff, the president and CEO of James Madison's Montpelier, located in beautiful Orange County, Virginia. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Welcome, Donald. And our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. And when you're doing that, think about your next trip, your next family vacation. Visit Montpelier.org, Montpelier.org, and plan your visit to James Madison's home. My name is Stuart Harris. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.